Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 435 for July 27th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
We keep talking about doing a 15-year-old, 21-year-old, all this sort of thing. But to be honest, we never seem to have a lot of stock to sustain it. So all I've done over the years I've been here is try and do single cask releases or small batch releases to let people see that we are trying to produce a quality whiskey.
The International Wine and Spirit Competition announced its 2013 trophy winners this week, and there was a surprise among the usual contenders. Tiny Ben Nevis Distillery won the trophy for Best Single Malt Scotch 15 years and younger for its 15-year-old single cask bottling. Colin Ross is the managing director at Ben Nevis and joins me later on for this week's Whiskey Cast in Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the Stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. William Grant & Sons dominated the other trophies at the International Wine & Spirit Competition this year with three overall winners. The Balvenie 40-year-old won Best Single Malt Scotch over 15 years old, while Glenfiddich 40-year-old won the trophy for Best Cask Strength Scotch, and Grant's 18-year-old won the trophy for Best Blended Scotch. Glenmorangie's Signet won for Best Single Malt Scotch with no age statement. And, of course, Ben Nevis's 15-year-old single cask won Best Single Malt Scotch 15 years and younger. Again, more on that in a few minutes. The competition does not award a trophy for Irish whiskies, but gave its first bourbon trophy this year to Eagle Rare 10-year-old from Buffalo Trace. King Carr's Cavalan Solist ex-bourbon single cask won the trophy for Best Worldwide Whiskey. There were also medals awarded to dozens of whiskeys from around the world. You'll find a link to the results at whiskeycast.com. By the way, the IWSC Distiller of the Year Awards will be announced in November. On that note, an update now from last week's story on the International Spirits Challenge Awards. As I was recording last week's episode, they had not yet posted the award for Distiller of the Year. Suntory was the winner. Another update now. Last fall, Louisville air quality regulators filed complaints against Diageo and other local whiskey producers over fungus on homes and buildings near their bourbon warehouses. The complaint blamed alcohol vapors from the Angels share at those warehouses for the fungus, and a separate class action lawsuit is seeking damages for the building owners. Now, Louisville's Air Pollution Control District has reached an agreement with Diageo to move 185,000 barrels of whiskey from one of its sites on the city's west side. Diageo will move some of the barrels from its Miller's Lane warehouses to its site at the old Stitzel Weller Distillery, about half a mile away. Those barrels are the ones that will be sold as Kentucky bourbon, specifically Bullet bourbon, while the rest will be sent to warehouses in Tennessee near its George Dickel Distillery. The difference? The Kentucky whiskey has to be matured in Kentucky. The rest can be matured in Tennessee. The Louisville Courier-Journal reports that the neighborhood's city council member is not pleased with the decision. Mary Woolridge claims it's just moving the problem around the corner. The director of the Air Pollution Control District has gone on record as saying the Stitzel Weller site is in compliance with air quality regulations. By the way, that class action lawsuit is still pending in federal court, and the district will not comment on what action may be pending against the city's other whiskey producers. Now for the latest on the White & Mackay saga. The UK's Office of Fair Trading officially confirmed this week that it is looking into Diageo's acquisition of a controlling stake in India's United Spirits, and whether that would give Diageo too much control over the Scotch whiskey market. The regulators are concerned that adding the United Spirits-owned White & Mackay assets into Diageo's portfolio could give the company too much control over grain whiskey production. The deadline for written outside comments is August 2nd. The Office of Fair Trading has 40 days to complete its investigation. Their options are to either sign off on the deal, work with Diageo to come up with a solution, meaning a sale of at least some of the White & Mackay assets, or send the case up to the UK's Competition Commission for more action. In other news, back in March, I reported that Buffalo Trace was preparing to release a younger and much more widely available version of its legendary George T. Stagg bourbon. This week, the distillery officially confirmed that Stagg Jr. will be released next month. Like the original Stagg, it's uncut and unfiltered, and the debut batch will be from 8 and 9-year-old barrels bottled at 67.2% ABV. Plans are to release several batches of Stagg Jr. each year, and Buffalo Trace has been laying down stocks for several years to make sure there won't be any impact on the annual release of George T. Stagg each fall as part of the Buffalo Trace antique collection. If you're outside the U.S., it'll be just as hard to find Stagg Jr., though. There appear to be no plans to export it for now. Only one other new whiskey release to mention this week. Beaumont is releasing a 23-year-old port cask matured single malt. It was distilled back in 1989 and will be bottled at a cask strength 50.8% ABV. Look for it starting in August at around £350 or about $540 a bottle. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Before we get to your voice, I'd like to thank the folks at Imbibe Magazine. Earlier this week, they released their list of the top 10 drinks podcasts on the web, and WhiskeyCast was the only spirits podcast on the list. The others were all beer and wine related. I'd like to thank the folks at Imbibe for their support. This week's Your Voice segment is brought to you by Highland Park. Had a very interesting email from Chris Garner, and he posed a question I haven't heard before. Here's what he had to say. First off, congratulations on putting together a fine podcast. This is my second year exploring whiskeys, and your podcast has been a great resource. I have a question regarding bourbon and sherry casks. I'm thinking that I should really try some sherries and bourbons to have a greater understanding of their impact on the whiskeys that I drink, so that will be one of my goals for the year. Do the distilleries disclose where they source their casks from, or is that a trade secret? It would be good to have the bourbon and sherry side by side with the whiskey to see the impact it has on the whiskey. Is this worth pursuing, or is it too pedantic? Chris, it's an interesting idea, and first off, let's clarify before anyone emails me on this point. Bourbon, of course, is whiskey. Scotch, of course, is whiskey, but not all whiskey is scotch, nor is it bourbon. Now, first off, there are only a few cases where comparing a scotch to a bourbon might show some similarities, specifically, since most distilleries in Scotland source their bourbon casks from a variety of distillers. You can't, of course, just compare a bourbon cask matured whiskey to a bourbon and you're going to get a pretty good idea. Now, one of the exceptions is Laphroaig, which is part of the Beam portfolio. Officially, Laphroaig sources all of its bourbon casks from Maker's Mark, though I have seen and have photos of Jim Beam-labeled casks there as well. Now, as for those sherry casks, a number of distilleries have casks made for them and lease them out to bodegas in Spain to be filled up with sherry for a couple of years of seasoning. In some cases, that sherry just gets dumped out or winds up being vatted into the bodega's other stocks, so you probably will never find it being sold on its own. Instead, just like with bourbon, it's worth trying to find scotches with a specific type of sherry cask, such as an Oloroso or Pedro Jimenez cask, and then taste those alongside those specific types of sherry. That'll give you an idea of what to look out for without going nuts trying to track down specific brands of sherry. If you have a question or a suggestion, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com or on our Facebook page. You can also email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com, and I do read every email. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name is Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The next McTeers Whiskey Auction is coming up on Wednesday in Glasgow. The Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming will have its monthly First Friday single malt tasting this week. Whiskey Live Sydney is on Friday and Saturday. Royal Mile Whiskies in Edinburgh will hold its annual Whiskey Fringe Festival August 9th through the 11th. The Glenlivet will host its next Guardians Whiskey School at the distillery in Speyside August 12th through the 14th. Reserve 101 in Houston will have a Garrison Brothers bourbon tasting on August 14th. New York City's Brandy Library will hold a spirit school class on Japanese whiskeys August 20th. And by coincidence, Sam Snead's House of Whiskey in Auckland, New Zealand will hold its own Japanese whiskey tasting the next day. Woodford Reserve's final Bourbon Academy class of the year is on August 24th. And the Whiskey Guild's annual Hudson River tasting cruise is August 29th in New York City. Right now, there are 249 different whiskey events on the calendar at WhiskeyCast.com. You can search for events in your area or anywhere you're traveling in the next few months. The calendar is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Jerry McCarthy, stillhouse operator, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
There was a time, you know, we brought in 12 barrels, and I was asked to, I was foreman in the warehousing at the time, and it was to be handled by Noel and then myself and the supervisor in question, Dennis McSweeney. And we put it together, made it up. I was told to band them, strap them, get them onto the back of a lorry. They were being shipped off up to Dublin, and they were special. And I was told it was liquid gold. It was actually Redbreast.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Ask a Scotsman about Ben Nevis, and you're more likely to hear about hiking to the top of the UK's highest mountain than about the whiskey that shares its name. Ben Nevis Distillery is in Fort William and was built back in 1825. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention in recent years, but Colin Ross and his small team keep plugging away. This week they won the International Wine and Spirit Competition's trophy for Best Single Malt Scotch 15 years and younger. And that has their spirits soaring as high as, well, at least as high as the top of Ben Nevis. Colin Ross joined me by phone from Fort William for this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Congratulations on the IWSC award, because you guys don't get nearly the recognition that I know you'd probably like to get among single malt whiskeys, right?
Well, we are getting that recognition that's coming through now. More and more people are aware. Last year we got a gold outstanding for our McDonald's traditional Ben Nevis malt, which is a peat-flavoured one. And then this year, a gold outstanding for the 15-year-old. So we're, for a small company like ourselves, we're absolutely delighted.
Tell me about that 15-year-old, because that was a fairly rare bottling too, right?
It is. We did three casks. We're on the selling the third one now. We bottled them last September, got the first one out in time for Christmas. It's three casks. Sherry casks that we bottled as a single casks.
Tell me what it's like being at a small distillery that, while it's owned by Asahi and Nika, is fairly independent within Scotland, in that you don't have any ties to any of the other distilleries, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, yes. It can be a bit lonely at times, but obviously we're out of the, having spent my formative years on Speyside and being close to neighbouring distilleries, and then coming to Ben Nevis for a short time under Long John's ownership. I then moved to Laphroaig again, where we were in with a group of other distillers, which was great. Come back here, and for the last 20-odd years, we're just on our, out on our own, out on a limb, it feels like. But there's something nice about that as well.
Now, you mentioned Long John. A lot of folks have heard vague things about Long John in the past, but Ben Nevis was actually founded by the original Long John MacDonald, right?
That's correct, yes. Long John MacDonald and a partner, I think it was Alexander, Alexander McDonnell, together founded Ben Nevis Distillery, we believe, in 1825. I think Long John himself, his partner had left him or got out of the business, and Long John himself was sequestrated around 1856, the same year he died. But his son was financed to take over the business, and he was the guy who really made a success of it. Ben Nevis whiskey was being exported all around the world. It was probably one of the biggest sellers of malt at that particular time. The McDonald family owned the distillery right on until 1944. The Long John name was something that Long John's son, Donald P. McDonald, introduced in respect or homage of his father when he named his whiskey Long John's Celebrated Jew of Ben Nevis. Then in 1922, the whiskey had been marketed by a company called W.H. Chaplin Wine and Spirit Merchants with offices in London and Glasgow. And about 1922, the distillery wanted to actually take back the marketing distribution themselves from Chaplin's. And it was agreed as a settlement that Chaplin's would retain the Long John name and the distillery would continue with the Ben Nevis and Jew of Ben Nevis trademarks. Move on in history to probably the end of the Second World War, and Shenley Corporation owned Seeger Evans, the gin distillery, who had owned Strathclyde, a grain distillery in Glasgow, along with Kinclaith, a malt unit within the grain distillery. They were looking for a brand name for their whiskies. They had actually acquired W.H. Chaplin at some stage, and looking for a trade name came across the Long John name. So their brand became Long John, and the company became Long John Distilleries, completely separate from Ben Nevis Distillery, who after the Second World War was owned by Mr. Hobbs, Joseph Hobbs, who then sold it, or his son sold it, in 1981 to Long John Distilleries. So there was an opportunity there to bring the two names back together, but it never happened because Mr. Hobbs's whiskey had mixed reputation, and Long John decided that they would not sell any Ben Nevis whiskey for at least 10 years. Before the 10 years were up, they sold the distillery to Nika, and Nika chose not to buy the Long John name, unfortunately, claiming that Suntory were the agents or the importers in Japan. So sadly, the two names never actually came together again after 1922.
And the Long John name has sort of faded away while Ben Nevis remains.
The Long John name, I think, is still in certain markets. It's now owned by Pernod Ricard, so part of the Chivas empire. And I think that I've had words with their archivist or assistant archivist earlier this year. And I think that they must be trying to resurrect the name, particularly in France, where it had been very successful for the company that I worked for back in the 1980s.
So tell me about the Nika connection, because we all are familiar with Suntory and its role at Morrison Bowmore, but there are many people who would be very surprised to hear that Nika and Asahi own a distillery in Scotland as well.
Yeah. The founding father of whiskey production in Japan was, in actual fact, Mr. Masataka Taketsuru, who came to Scotland in 1918 to study at Glasgow University, to study whisky making and production. During his breaks from university, he went out to Hazelbank Distillery in Campbelltown, and he was up at Longmorn Distillery in Elgin, getting some practical experience in distilling, picking up a lot of information, making copious notes. He returned to Japan in 1924 with a a Scottish wife by this stage, and went back to the family spirits business, and with a shopping list looking for pot stills and the various equipment he would need to actually produce whisky, rather than what they were doing at the time was flavouring spirit to make it taste like whisky. I think that the family business had said, no, we don't have that sort of sums of money. We just want you to, with your experience, produce a better flavoured spirit, more akin to the whisky you're aware of. And I think that Mr. Takatsuri was approached by the company that's now called Suntory, but whatever their name was before at that time, and said, look, we have the money, you have the knowledge, why don't we get together? And so they built the Yamazaki distillery together, and Mr. Takatsuru remained with the company for about 10 years. Depending on who tells the story, Mr. Takatsuru always had this dream to have his own distillery, so he left. But in actual fact, whilst he'd been involved in the whisky business and setting up the whisky business for Suntory, towards the end of his time with him, he was actually transferred into producing beer. And I don't know whether this is their way of saying, look, we don't want you anymore, or what it was. But he went away on his own to Yoichi up in Hokkaido and started his own distillery there with one pot still. And he used it to distill from the wash into low wines. And then once collected the low wines, he would change the pipework around on the still, and he would use the second batch of distilling the low wines to produce his paints and his spirit run and collect it. And he kept changing the pipework around. His intention had always been to mature his whisky for 3 years, as they had done in Scotland when he was there, at least 3 years. And in order to do so, and in order to finance this operation, he, being in Yoichi, it was a great fruit growing area, he was producing apple juice, apple brandy and cider, as well as other fruit juices. And I believe that the NIKKA name is the N for Nihon, Japanese, and the other letters, don't ask me what they are, but there's something to do with a fruit juice company or a fruit company. And that's where he started in 1934, and then went on in 1969 to build the distillery at Miyakagyo at Sendai, but also warehousing complexes at Toshigi, just outside Tokyo, and Kashima. They have a cider producing plant up in the north of Honshu Island, Hirosaki, and I think they had some offices in Kyushu, in the south, the bottling, I think it was. They also had a grain still near Osaka, but I think that went in the 60s, but that was dismantled and rebuilt at Sendai a few years ago within Miyakagyo. So they just have the two distillation units now in Japan, but producing, I think, some fairly well-respected whiskies.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. So, and they bought Ben Nevis in 1989. The Takatsurus themselves had no family of their own, but they adopted Masatake Takatsuru, nephew, Takeshi Takatsuru, and he was heading up the company in around the time that they bought the distillery. Obviously, there was a lot of debate going on. I didn't hear this at the time, but I've since heard that they were voting on whether to decide to buy Ben Nevis or not, and the board was split 50-50, and it was the chairman's casting vote, so I think it may have been something to do with the fact that his mother, who'd adopted him, had come from Scotland. I don't know, but I've also heard something to do with the fact that the Japanese have a reverence for mountains, and certainly with Miyakago Distillery, there's a nice high mountain as a backdrop to that distillery, and obviously Ben Nevis has the Britain's highest mountain behind it, so maybe that had been the reason.
And more people know you for, or know the name Ben Nevis for the mountain than for the distillery, but
of course,
I know you're trying to change that, of course.
Well, I'm quite happy if they know the mountain. They'll then know that the water runs off that mountain and hopefully realize that we use that water to produce a decent whiskey.
Now, the way I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, some of your spirit, or at least some of your new make, goes back to Japan,
it
right?
It does, yes.
Yeah. And they use it for Nika Black, right?
Well,
or for other spirits.
I've been told that it's used for Nika Black, but when I questioned the last president about this, he told me that it was all the malts that go into Nika Black Clear are matured. It's only the grain whiskey that's immature that goes into that product. It's over a million case seller, that one. Obviously selling on price. But I can't comment. They keep their cards close to their chest, as you know.
Of course. That with the competition between Nika and Suntory, they don't talk a lot about what they're doing with their whiskey, and I think we're all sort of very familiar with that. So tell me how the distillery has changed over the years, because I know there have been changes, but not a lot, right?
Not a lot, no. It changed, I suppose, we took over, I first came here in 1983 as manager, but the year before I had come down a couple of times to be responsible for some trial mashes for Long John. I was working at Tom Moore at the time. There was a very, very old wort cooler with heavy bronze gunmetal plates that obviously the rubber gaskets were no longer available. It was leaking like a sieve where we used it. The mash tun was 5-ton capacity. The bronze gunmetal filter plates on the bottom, the false bottom, had been kicked in so much that the plates had worn away, and we had actually inserted pieces of timber to take up the slack when we were mashing. They installed, after the trial mashes, the two sets, it was two loads of malt, one in the spring of the year and one in December that we mashed, probably three mashes out of each load. It would be more than that because it was 25 tons. It would have been like five mashes out of each load that we did on these trials. Using the equipment that was there, they then decided to reopen the distillery for production based on the quality of the spirit they got in April 84 with an investment something like £250,000 at the time, which wasn't a huge sum of money even then. We got a new hot liquor tank with a division plate in it. They repaired the mash tun rake gear. We still had to shovel the draft out by hand. We stole a wort cooler from Glenugie Distillery because it was being dismantled, and some other equipment from there. We had to strip some checker plate flooring from the grain still area, patch it up and use it ourselves in the mash house. But we had a very superb opening because the distilleries were closing at that time. Here was Ben Nevis reopening. We got some fantastic televised publicity that big lorry at the back of the distillery with a dish on it, and they were firing the picture from the distillery, from the mash house, up to a satellite over Africa, which was then beamed back down to London and come up by landline to Long John's warehouse complex in Glasgow where the managing director was conducting the opening of the distillery, if you like, remotely.
I remember those old days of transcontinental and international satellite hops and when it was still all a novelty in the broadcast field.
Yes.
And as you pointed out, the distillery really came back to life at a time when probably 20 or 30 distilleries were closing during that dark time of the 1982-1983 time period.
But unfortunately, Long John couldn't sustain it. In 1986, they ceased production at Ben Nevis, and what production we were due to do for the remainder of the year was transferred to Laphroaig and Tormore in order to run them at a better, more profitable level of production. So we lost out at that time, and the distillery lay silent again until Nika purchased it in 1989, refurbished it with about £750,000 worth of new equipment, the new mash tun, new boiler, some new fermenters. We stepped up from a 5-ton mash to a 9-ton capacity mash tun. Larger washbacks and fermenters, but the same stills. And then a further $250,000 investment the following year in the visitor centre.
How many visitors do you get a year out in Fort William?
The first full year we had just short of 50,000, and that numbers have varied since 92 it would have been as the first full season. We opened in July 91. We've gone back from that near 50 to around about, on average I'd say 30, but we've been down as low as 20, and depending on what's going on. We've been unable to maintain the distillery as well as we would like, and sometimes it's not so attractive as we would have hoped for visitors.
But with the recent attention you've been getting for your whiskies, perhaps that could change, right?
Well, we've been trying to do that with our whiskies, I suppose, since I first came here in the Long John days, and getting the chance to come back in 1989 under the Japanese ownership. I thought this was an opportunity to try and do something and regain the reputation that the whiskey had back in the 1880s.
What makes the spirit unique?
I don't know. Everybody asks these questions, but the only thing that's unique, our unique selling point, I think, is the fact that we're the only distillery using the water from Ben Nevis itself, Britain's highest mountain. Whether that makes it unique, I don't know. We've got big stills, which I think give us a fairly big character. You've got Speyside malts being quite light, and then you've got the Isla malts being kind of heavy. And I suppose geographically we're halfway in between, so maybe ours is a bit more heavy in character than Speyside, but not so heavy as the Islas.
What are you doing to beef up the range? I know you have the basic 10-year-old single malt, but what are you doing to expand that range and make more of your whiskey available to consumers?
What we're doing? Well, we keep talking about doing a 15-year-old, 21-year-old, all this sort of thing. But to be honest, we never seem to have a lot of stock to sustain it. So all I've done over the years I've been here is try and do single cask releases or small batch releases to let people see that we are trying to produce a quality whiskey. And I think so far we've succeeded in that, and it's now a case of trying to keep that and looking at stock if we can go. I mean, we've got all the blends. We've got three blends without an age statement, all different blends as entry-level ones. We've got a 12-year-old blend. I think the Japanese, when they opened the distillery in Japan, blends were the drink. Nobody was drinking malts to the same extent as they are today, and the emphasis was on producing the blends and getting blends out there. And they didn't seem to appreciate that in Scotland we'd moved on to pursuing the malt side. So most of the whiskey that we had was going into blends. But we, as I say, we just keep looking at what we can do, what we've got available, and just trying to release some of the best casks, just to build that reputation for a quality whiskey. And this latest award is something that we're really delighted about to help us in that respect.
How much are you able to meet the demand for single malt from Ben Nevis?
That's going to be our problem. As I see it, that was a problem, because we've sold so much for blend and so much for bulk to keep the distillery financed over these few years, that now the demand is coming, we may not have enough whiskey for that. But I've been there before when I was at Laphroaig, when they had to restrict the sales, and instead of selling X number of pallets or whatever to a customer, they had to cut it down and say, look, that's all we can give you just now until the stocks increased. And it didn't harm their reputation. So I'm hoping that something similar may well be able to happen here.
How do you differentiate between the blends, which also carried the Ben Nevis name too, right?
Yeah.
And the single malt?
We this was something that the Scotch Whisky Association pulled Nika and myself in on not long after they bought the distillery. They suggested, because in actual fact, before, they must have been showing signs to Long John or James Burrard Distillers, as they were then known, indicating that they had been interested in Ben Nevis Distillery, because I heard it announced while I was at Laphroaig on the radio that in December 88 that Long John had sold the Ben Nevis and the Dew of Ben Nevis trademarks to this Japanese distillery company, Nika. Well, I thought that was a bit stupid because the distillery wasn't worth anything if the trademarks were away. But then, obviously, they bought the distillery, I think it was April in 89. So with these two trademarks, there were the two trademarks, but Ben Nevis and Dew of Ben Nevis. In the time that Mr. Hobbs owned the distillery, Dew of Ben Nevis was a blend, and he actually produced a whiskey that was blended at birth. He had a grain plant in here from 1955, and he produced grain spirit and malt spirit and mixed them on day one and allowed them to mature together. And this was his Dew of Ben Nevis. Whereas, I suppose, in Long John's son's day, when he was calling it the Long John celebrated Dew of Ben Nevis, basically he was referring to it as the malt whiskey from Ben Nevis, and may even have had the malt whiskey from the Nevis distillery, which he also, Donald P. McDonald built the Nevis distillery, and I think he was mixing the malts from the two distilleries. So the Dew of Ben Nevis come in there. So asked by the Scotch Whisky Association, I felt that we should just simplify things, single malt Ben Nevis and the blend Dew of Ben Nevis, which was accepted by them at the time, and because they'd accepted it, Nika accepted it as well. But that was fine, and then 2005, Scotch Whisky Association asked distillers to attend meetings. They were discussing introducing the new regulations for Scotch whisky, and so that all companies were dealing with things the same way. And at that time, Dew of Ben Nevis was going to be an exception because they didn't want the malt having the same name as the blend. But because Dew of Ben Nevis had been used so long, they'd agreed that would be an exception. However, when the new regulations came in, there was no exceptions at all. So we've now had to change the name of our blend to Nevis Dew. And we're in the throes of doing that. Any time that we're rebottling blends, a new batch coming out, it's Nevis Dew.
So that's an important thing for our consumers as they see this. It's not an all new blend. It's the same.
It's the same, Dew of Ben Nevis blend,
with
but just the name
a new name
changed
to keep the regulators happy.
Yeah, that's it. So it's,
that must have been a source of contention for you guys, because
redo
all the labels, right?
And the Dew of Ben Nevis name had been in use at least since 1882. You know, it's a long part of our history. But what can you do? You argue it, you go to your MP, you do everything you can, but the answer still comes back, no.
What's the future hold for you guys?
I suppose, personally, retirement. At my age, 48 years in the whiskey business, not in any hurry to go, I'll be honest, but future, I think, is looking pretty good at the moment. Obviously, with the world demand for whiskey, the number of new inquiries that we're getting is unbelievable. I think the future is looking very good. Obviously, I need to find someone to take over for myself and ease myself out, but I still feel I've so many things I'd like to get done that I personally am in no hurry. I don't know that Nika and Asahi have the same opinion.
Well, tell everybody to send their CVs to you if you're interested.
But yeah, if we get somebody, I had a young chap, he was quite keen, and then he left he took on Dalmore Distillery last year, so we're back at the throes of looking for someone.
That's got to be a hard thing for you after 48 years, and then you've got to try to find a successor and then trying to find just the right person to carry on a legacy of a distillery that's going to be essentially 190 years old here in a couple of years.
That's right. Yep.
And carry on that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
What do you look for in somebody to carry on that legacy for another 48 years?
Basically, I would like someone that has got a practical background, that knows distilling inside out, that can carry forward in a traditional manner, because I think that maybe that's something that helps make our whiskey that little bit different, in the same way as some of the whiskies like Yoichi and some of those direct, we don't have direct fire stills, unfortunately, but I think, like say Yoichi malt, coal-fired stills, I think some of the traditional whiskies have the edge on all this computerized spirit that's coming out nowadays.
There's a lot more character to it.
I think so. I mean, when I was at Lafroy, the manager from Lagavulin was leaving to take up a position at Glenkinchie Distillery. We went up to wish him all the best, a group of the managers on the island, before he would leave. And while we're there, he said, you know, I've just got the very thing, boys. And this was a bottle of malt mill, the sister distillery to Lagavulin. In his opinion, it had been produced before the First World War. The bottling date was shown as about 1924 or something. And the whiskey had been opened. There had been a little bit taken out. But he poured us all a little taste. And it really was completely different from the whiskies in most places today. It wasn't fiery, it wasn't harsh, it was just so smooth that it went down like, I don't know, like nectar from the gods, to quote from our video. And it was so good that he said, he says, I know this sample should be left at the distillery, but come on, it's too good. And we finished the bottle.
I can't say as I blame you.
It was a lovely drop of stuff. And I do think it was different from what's been produced today.
There is still at least one sample of malt mill left at Lagavulin, though. Lagavulin Distillery Manager Georgie Crawford told us about it last July in episode 376. You can find it in the archives at whiskeycast.com, and you'll also find links for the Ben Nevis Distillery website, too. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Now, official bottlings of Ben Nevis are hard enough to find that I don't have any tasting notes for one, but let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of its cousins. As we heard, the distillery is owned by Nika, and Nika Super is one of its flagship blended whiskies. It is available outside Japan, primarily in Europe. It's bottled at 43% ABV, and the nose is warm and peppery, with honey sweetness underneath, along with notes of allspice, ginger, and nutmeg. The taste is thick and spicy, with black pepper, ginger, honey, vanilla, and a touch of chocolate, and the finish is long and spicy with pepper and honey notes. Don't know whether any of that Ben Nevis spirit is in it, but it is very nice. I'm scoring Nika Super an 87. Colin mentioned that when Ben Nevis closed in the mid-80s, some of its production was moved to Tormore. Again, another official bottling that's hard to find, but Master of Malts, that boutique-y whiskey company, bottled a cask of Tormore recently. Tormore batch number 1 is bottled at 50% ABV, and the nose has notes of honey, toffee, ginger snaps, vanilla wafers, and a touch of malt. The taste is thin at first, but builds up strongly with black pepper that fades to reveal honey, toffee, red apples, vanilla, and a hint of ginger. The finish is dry with a lingering spiciness, and I'm scoring Tormore batch number 1 from Master of Malt an 83. I received a sample of Two Gingers Irish whiskey the other day. It's distilled at Kilbeggan, and the Minnesota-based brand was acquired by Beam earlier this year. It's a blended Irish whiskey bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is malty with orange peel, caramel, and honey notes. The taste is light and thin at first, but a strong pepperiness kicks in with lemon and honey notes underneath, along with touches of malt in the background. The finish is light, long, and spicy. I'm scoring Two Gingers an 83. I've added these tasting notes to the searchable list of more than 1,000 different whiskeys at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, the latest whiskey news, your voice, and a searchable archive of past episodes, along with a whole lot more. You can also subscribe to WhiskeyCast, WhiskeyCast HD, and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings at iTunes, as well as other podcast sites. And if you do, please leave some feedback. It helps other whiskey lovers discover WhiskeyCast, too. Of course, we're always available on the web at WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you each week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.